From the prophet Isaiah, 700 years before Jesus, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. For those who live in the place and shadow of death, on them a light will shine brightly. For a child is born to us, a son is given to us. The government will rest on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And then from Jesus' best friend, the Apostle John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. And again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life.
Thank you, Todd. If you have your Bible with you this morning, or maybe it's on a phone or on a tablet in an app, would you open to John chapter 8, John chapter 8, verse 12. If you don't have a Bible, you see the ushers are down right now. They'd love to give you a copy of God's Word, and if you don't own a Bible, please raise your hand and get a Bible from one of these guys, and so they can, you can take that home with you as our gift to you this morning. I also want to direct your attention, in case you're one who likes to take notes and jot things to yourself as you're going through a sermon, or you want to orient yourself in the sermon, we have a sermon guide that's in the weekly that you were handed, hopefully when you came in this morning, and so you can pull that out now if that would be of help to you. For those who haven't been with us, and for those who have, a reminder to you, we've been in the midst of a sermon series addressing the issue that Todd just read about in those texts, particularly from Isaiah as well as referenced by the Apostle John. Namely, that despite the holiday season, the darkness and the brokenness of this world do not go on holiday. And as a matter of fact, for many, the intensity of the darkness is only felt more keenly at this time of year. And our aim in this series has been to explore various kinds of responses to that reality for all of us. A couple of weeks ago, we took a look at the Scrooge, whose approach to the darkness was, yes, darkness is all around, and it always will be. Live accordingly. Just last week, we took a look at the shopper, whose approach to the darkness is, don't be so gloomy. Stoke the fires. Let's celebrate. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Looking at those two approaches, I think I reminded you in those weeks, I think I did, that they're fairly secular approaches to the Christmas holiday and to approaching the darkness. We noted that people like that generally aren't really believers. But in the words of Glenn Scrivener, the Santas of this world are different. They are spiritual, trusting that there is more to life than this valley of deep shadow. Unlike the Scrooges and the shoppers, Santas believe. And what do they believe if you find that you're this kind of Christmas, you're a Santa type? Well, they believe in Santa. And it may not be that they actually believe in a literal fat man living at the North Pole, but they do believe in the idea of Santa and what he represents. It's similar to, you remember how we talked about in the sermon on Scrooge, this idea from Dickens, his solution to the darkness being this Scrooge who would believe in the Christmas spirit. That was what would deliver us. That was the solution. Santa, for so many, is the spirit of Christmas. or at least he represents the spirit and the light and the life of Christmas. And you might ask, or maybe we can reflect, how does that play out? Well, in Santa, we have someone who lives very far away. He's irrelevant to the vast majority of our lives, but he brings about a time of year where when we really want something, joy or happiness, or maybe something that we think will bring us joy and happiness, that he will give us those things if we just put in a request. And he doesn't ever really show up, not that we actually see. And frankly, it's not that we really want him to show up anyway, because who wants a big fat guy sitting at your Christmas table? We just want him to deliver the goods, to bring some light and life, to push back the darkness and go on his way. Thank you very much. And if you stop and think about it for just a bit, there is a bit of a dark side to Santa. He's making a list and checking it twice. Gonna find out who's naughty or nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. He knows when you are sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows when you've been bad or good. So be good for goodness sake. It's just a little bit creepy. And what we learn from this popular song is, I mean, think about it. The idea that Santa is some generous being who lives far away and shows up to give good gifts to the children of the world is really all wrong. He doesn't give gifts. He gives rewards for good behavior. And if you find yourself on the naughty list, well, you better watch out, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Now, do I go too far in this dark side of Santa? I don't think so. I think things in our culture like, okay, so have you heard of Shelf on the Elf? Excuse me, thank you. That would be more awkward, wouldn't it? A poor little elf would just need deliverance. Okay, so you clearly are familiar with the Elf on the Shelf craze. So, right, here's the idea for those of you who may not be. A parent can buy this little elf and then read a story to their kids about how it's one of Santa's scouts, right? And then what this scout does is watch the behavior of each child in the home, and every night he magically transports back to Santa Claus and gives a report. This is from the story that you buy with Elf on the Shelf. Each night while you're sleeping, to Santa I'll fly. I'll tell him if you have been good or bad. The news of the day makes him happy or sad. I'll be back at your home before you awake, and then you must find the new spot I will take. And the nightly task, of course, of the parent then is to move the little elf on the shelf to bring life to the story. And again, that's not creepy at all. But it's certainly popular. Did you know that the Elf on the Shelf has 1.3 million fans on Facebook? 750,000 Twitter followers? 220,000 Instagram followers? And has raked in tens of millions of dollars? Man, I wish I would have come up with this idea. All while seeking to change the behavior of millions of children. And let's be honest. Can we be honest with each other? When it comes to the holidays and gift giving, that kind of thinking of the elf on the shelf and your behavior being watched, and then it depends on what you're going to get based on that behavior, it's not present merely in children. It remains under the surface in adults almost as much. How many of us still have the thought, I've been pretty good this year. I'm guessing she's going to get me some pretty good gifts this year. I'm a really good employee. I can't wait for that Christmas bonus this year. It's still there. Furthermore, sadly and quite seriously, this kind of Santa life belief pervades all of life for so many people. They think that their behavior, whether they are good or bad, will determine not merely the outcome of the holiday season, but the outcome of their lives. It's often how they think of God as well, if they think of him at all. God becomes this Santa-like figure in the sky that we don't really want to be a large part of our lives, but we would like to put in a request every now and then. And it's our belief that we can just muster up a bit of good behavior with the old man that he will justly reward us for all of our efforts and provide what we would like. The rewards will be ours, and he can go on his merry way. But there are some fairly significant issues with this kind of approach to Christmas. Chief among them, that it doesn't really work at pushing back the darkness. Not for long, anyway. We all know this. Santa is not the true light. Even at Christmas, the darkness of loss and the brokenness of this world, the difficulty of life, press in on us. Just this week, I spent time with people in our church family who are feeling the deep pain of relational conflict, for whom going home to family brings about a tremendous amount of stress and anxiety and tension. Just this morning, in both of the prayer times that happened this morning, multiple people prayed for that very reality, for people who will feel griefs and burdens. It's what we've been talking about these last few weeks, and that doesn't go away just because it's Christmas. And even if a Santa kind of belief and an embracing of this notion of some kind of vague Christmas spirit could bring holiday cheer, it is literally only for a season. It comes around just one day a year. And then there's always, right, the inevitable taking down of the lights and the tinsel and the tree, and many are then left with unsatisfied hopes and longings. Maybe even despair, and they face another year of waiting and dreaming for when it may finally be the most wonderful time of the year, and maybe it could just stick around for a while. I hope that you understand that you are not the first people to grapple with darkness. Isaiah's bold declaration that Todd read for us this morning and that we've been meditating on reveals as much. He speaks of a people walking in darkness, of a people in the place of the shadow of death. And Isaiah writes in a time on behalf of God, speaking to God's people, the nation of Israel, a time of particularly deep darkness. God was judging his people for their waywardness and their rebellion. They had not been nice, but were decidedly naughty. And in the worst of all possible ways. And as a result, the hammer of the nation of Assyria in God's hand was going to be used as a tool of punishment over and upon his people. And when Isaiah asked God, "How long, God? How long is that going to happen? How long is the darkness going to descend upon us?" God's reply was chilling. Quote, "Until every house is empty, until every city is destroyed, until every last inhabitant of this land is carried far away from here, everything is going to burn." And it was a time that would usher in literally hundreds of years of darkness. It was a time that would carry on from Isaiah and God's people to the time of Ezekiel, when Ezekiel would declare on behalf of God the word Ichabod over God's people, which means the glory is gone, which meant that the light of the magnificence and the presence of God had departed and the people were left in darkness. As time passes in the biblical story and prophet after prophet speaks, we read how this darkness and this silence brought about by the departure of Yahweh God from his people goes all the way to the last book of the Old Testament, the last prophet of God, Malachi, where this slim shaft of the light of promise faintly would shine in the darkness through the words of Malachi. And the promise does not tell of a man who will come from far away dressed in red on a sled to break the darkness. Rather, God declared this through Malachi, "Behold, I will send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple." The Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, mark that. "And the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says Yahweh of heaven's armies. For you who fear my name, the sun, the light of righteousness shall rise with healing in his wings. And you shall go out leaping like calves from the stall." I think it's fascinating that in the life of God's people, for the next 400 years of silence, there would be no other prophets for the next 400 years. God's voice would be silent, his presence absent. Those 400 years were marked every year by an annual, they were punctuated by an annual celebration that God himself had initiated and commanded be observed. It was called the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, it didn't happen in winter like our annual celebration. Rather, it happened at harvest time. And the reason that it happened at harvest time was very intentional on God's part. God wanted his people to celebrate the gifts of his provision that he had given to them. They were to remember when they left Egypt. Do you remember the story of Moses and the great Exodus? How they had gotten out of slavery, and then they went into the wilderness for many, many years, right? Like that was a time when there were no harvests, and there were no crops, and there were no homes. And so the people would come together once a year at this Feast of Tabernacles to commemorate and to celebrate the great things that God had done for them by rescuing them and for how he had provided for them in the wilderness. I think it's helpful to understand what their holiday traditions were at this annual holiday. They were to build themselves little booths, little tabernacles. They were called tabernacles because they were highly mobile, right? They weren't permanent structures. It was to remember that time that they were in the wilderness. So they would build these little tabernacles, and everybody who was within 20 miles of the city of Jerusalem was all commanded to come into the city. So imagine Jerusalem and all the surrounding hills just dotted with all of these little tabernacles where people were living in these temporary dwellings, remembering what it was like for their forefathers. Another thing that they would do on this seven-day holiday, a daily rite, would be to pour out water. So, right, you got to get yourself, you got to picture yourself now in Jerusalem. You're looking on the hills, you've seen all these little tabernacles that are all around. The city's just packed with people. And every morning, the great high priest would grab a gold pitcher, and he would lead a procession out of the city to the Pool of Siloam. And he would fill that pitcher with water from the Pool of Siloam. And then there would be this great band that was marching behind him, and everyone would march behind the high priest into the temple's precincts, where they had built this huge platform next to the massive altar there in the temple precincts. And the priest every morning would then take that water and would pour it out on the altar. It was said that for an Israelite, it was just this deep longing. If you got to see the water actually being poured out of the bowl onto the altar, it was like your life was made. And that happened every single morning. Now, why did they do that? To remember. It was to remind them, even in the midst of the darkness, of the absence of the glory, of the Shekinah glory, the light of the presence of God for centuries. It was to remember God was our source of life in the wilderness. When Moses struck the rock and out of the rock came water, our forefathers did not die. It was to give them hope in the midst of darkness. And there was something else that they did at this annual celebration. Every night, they would celebrate something called the illumination of the temple. It took place in the treasury at the beginning of the feast, and it was a spectacular celebration. So picture this again now. Picture this temple area, the center of the treasury, where four great torches were set up, about 65 feet in the air, these massive torches. And at the top of those torches, 17 gallons of oil would reside with wicks. And the youngest of the priests, not the vintage priest, Candace, but the youngest of the priests would scurry up those torches and they would light those great torches and it would illuminate the entire temple and could be seen across the entire city. And in the Mishnah, which is this Jewish historical book, it was recorded that what would happen, here's the direct words, men of piety and good works would then dance before the massive torches with burning torches in their hands, singing songs and praises, and countless Levites would play on harps and lyres and cymbals and trumpets and instruments of music, and the people would dance until dawn. Does that not sound fantastic? I'm guessing they must have slept in the day because this went on for 7 days. Now, why did they do that every night? They did it to remember, to commemorate, to celebrate. They did it to remember how God had given them the gift of shelter, how God had given them the gift of water, how God had given them the gift of light in the wilderness. Why would they light torches, massive torches, in the middle of the temple precincts as a way of commemorating what God had done for them? Do you remember what happened when they were coming out of Egypt and they were going into the wilderness? How did God provide light for his people? There was this, do you remember what happened in the day, right? He would lead and guide them by this pillar of cloud. And then as the sun would begin to go down and dusk would start to happen, there would be this pulse and this radiation from in the midst of the cloud, and the cloud would start to grow brighter and brighter as it got darker and darker until it would be transformed completely into a pillar of fire. And why was there a cloud in the day and a pillar of fire at night? Was it merely just to be a compass for them and to be a light so they could find their way in the darkness? No. Remember what it says in Exodus chapter 13. It was important who was in that cloud and who was in that light. And Yahweh went before them by day in the pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them the light that they might travel by day and by night. This wasn't just some cloud, and it wasn't just some pillar of fire. This was God himself. So imagine being an Israelite in the temple's precincts, at the Feast of Tabernacles, in the great celebration before massive candelabra in this spectacular display of light that was meant to transport you back to that very time of the Shekinah glory of God himself. A flame, a fire in his presence among his people, lighting the way with you and near you and pushing back the darkness, because when God's presence was near, all was well. When God's light was radiating, all was good and safe. Do you remember the stories? It was his presence in the glory cloud that had delivered the law and the teachings guiding their lives. It was his presence in the glory cloud when it descended on the temple, causing everyone to fall on their faces in the warmth of worship, in the joy of his nearness, overcome with love. It was his presence in the glory cloud that had over and over again destroyed all their enemies. And that is what the torches signified every night of the feast and the annual celebration. It was, for an Israelite, the most wonderful time of the year. But now I want you to imagine the next day. after the feast is done. I want you to imagine them taking down the decorations, taking down the platform for the pouring of the water, taking down the massive torches, taking down the booths. I mean, we get this, right? Are you like me? Isn't it terrible to take down the Christmas tree? It's terrible. I have finally convinced my wife to at least leave up the white Christmas lights and the little pine bows that go up and down our stairwells by arguing it's not like truly Christmas, it's just kind of wintry. Just so I can have like more Christmas in our house for like we just want it to last longer. Don't we? Like the best parts of it. I get that it's hard sometimes, but like we just want it to stay. We take down our little stables with the wise men that we've constructed. We take down the Advent candles and the strings of lights. The celebration is over, and it feels like, and in a very real sense, kind of regular life floods back in. You tuck away that gaudy Christmas sweater and those crazy socks, that Santa hat. Imagine how much worse it was for the Israelites. Year after year, the light of God's presence had not been seen for generations. It all had to seem so hopeless. And I can imagine in my mind, like, you see the Israelites heading out of the city, right? Like those who don't live in Jerusalem any longer, and they're walking out of the city. I mean, can't you just imagine, like, Mark and Joe, you know, two good Jews, talking with each other, going, like, what? Why do we even keep doing this? I mean, why do we torture ourselves? What's the point of the great celebration and seeing the lights? Because the darkness just comes back and he's not here. And then, it's around 36 AD and the Feast of Tabernacles has once again ended. The decorations are being taken down and people are milling about for one last visit in the temple precincts before departing for home. And a man walks in with his followers trailing. And he stands before the blackened candelabras, now extinguished. He stands before a bleary-eyed, hopeless people, and raising his voice, he boldly declares, "I am the light of the world. And anyone who follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Can you imagine? Can you imagine an Israelite standing there? Can you picture what it would have been like? Now that the post-celebration darkness is descending, standing before them, this man, hearing what he is saying. We all remember the Shekinah glory of God who was there in the pillar of cloud by day, in the pillar of fire by night. That pillar was the very presence of Yahweh himself, guiding you, protecting you, providing for you. That is the presence that you have longed for, that your fathers and your great-grandfathers and your great-great-grandfathers have longed for. I am that glory. I am that light. I am the true light. I am not like the prophets who merely pointed to the glory. I am not like the teachers who merely reflected the glory. I am the glory of God. I am God come to you. I am the way that the light of God can come now permanently to you, into you. That will be the source of your life and deliverance from darkness. Veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail the incarnate deity, pleased as man with men to dwell. Jesus, our Emmanuel. Here there is no false light. There is no transitory pushing back of the darkness. There is no behavior that has forced the hand of God to give this gift. This was his plan from before time when the Son and the Father existed in perfect communion. John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. This light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. So that Jesus now promises, I am that true light. I am the light not merely in Jerusalem, not merely for the Jews. I am the light of the world. And if you will follow me, just like your fathers followed Yahweh behind that pillar of fire, if you will follow me, you will never walk in darkness, but have the light of life. Wait. What did he just say? Never walk in darkness? I mean, if you think about it for a second, that sounds a bit like Santa Claus. Isn't that the problem of Christmas, that it's always overpromising? There's this reality of our lives, this darkness that presses in on us, that screams against the promise of Jesus. The stories of pain and hurt that I listened to this week, darkness in the lives of people that I know and love, they're believers, they're followers of Christ, they read their Bibles, they pray, they are Christians, and they feel a loss of hope in difficult situations. They feel overwhelmed. Tears welled up in their eyes at the distress of their circumstances. And to me, that looked an awful lot like darkness. So what is Jesus on about? Does he have a bit of Santa-like naivete here about Christmas? All is light. There is no darkness. I thought about the words of Jesus and how he talked with his disciples, and I know that that can't be true of him. That can't be true, that he's naive to the darkness. Jesus is the one who said things like, in this world you will have trouble. The ruler of this world, Satan, is now coming. You will be hated by all for my name's sake. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. You will be dragged before governors and rulers and kings. You will be persecuted. You will be sent out as sheep among wolves. So I know that Jesus is not naive to the darkness that we face, because he knows that he hasn't fully brought his kingdom yet. That's not going to happen until his second advent. So how can he say difficult things about the truth and the reality of the darkness that surrounds us and is going to be our experience and say, if you follow me, you will never walk in darkness? How can both of those be true? I think what Jesus means is explained by what John said of him at the very beginning of his story in John chapter 1, verse 5. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. In other words, the darkness in our lives in this age, to a very real extent, will remain. But in Jesus, we have the light of light. Leon Morris says it this way: light is not a natural human possession. It comes only from Christ. And it is not a separable entity that may be possessed in itself. It is not an objective revelation that people may receive and hug to themselves. Jesus is the light. To have the light is to have Jesus. There is no light a part of a very real relationship with Jesus. So when we have Jesus, we have the light of life. They are one and the same. This is the marvel of the incarnation, friends. In the first covenant with his people, do you remember this? God could not dwell directly with his people, right? Like when the glory cloud came down on the mountain, what did the people do? They ran from the edge of the mountains and said, God, you got to stop like showing up like this. We can't handle it. God came as fire because it was a very real metaphor for who he was to his people. Like fire is good at a distance. I love a good fire in a fireplace, but I don't jump into the fire. That's the way it was with God. You could get close to him, but you couldn't jump into him because you'd be incinerated in your unrighteousness. But Jesus says that in me, all that has changed now. I am God in flesh. I am God with you. In me is a complete and new transformation and way. It is now safe to draw close. It is safe to draw all the way in, and it is necessary to do so, because in me, the whole of your life will be illuminated, and the coming of the light of who I am means in you a permanent transformation. We are freed from the darkness and the sphere of death. This is what the Bible teaches, friends. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 8, you were once darkness. It wasn't just that you were in the darkness, you were darkness, but now you are light in Jesus. Jesus will teach his followers in Matthew 5, 14, you are the light of the world. Paul will tell the Philippian Christians that the world is dark, but in which you shine like stars in the universe. That one day, we will shine like the sun in the kingdom of the Father. That in the new heavens, when all is complete, there will be no more night. We will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give us light, and we will reign forever and ever. Amen? So what does that mean? Practically. Well, it means that in Jesus we have the light, and we always will have the light to illumine our steps as we walk through this life. It means that we are to have hope and trust and faith in that, for Jesus has promised that it will be so. It means that in Jesus we will have the light of life. It means that while the darkness may at times surround us, dear friends, you will be surrounded by the darkness, but the darkness will not overcome you. That's what that means. The decorations in this way will never come down. The torches will never go out. The presence will never leave. The shelter will never falter. Are you picking that up here from Jesus today? Brothers and sisters, I want you to live hopefully and courageously in this truth. I mean, here's how it can feel sometimes as a Christian, right? Like on your own, or even when we're all gathered together, it can feel at times, and we get this as Minnesotans, it can feel like the darkness, let me mix my metaphors, is like this gigantic glacier that just seems to be overpowering and overcoming us. And what Jesus is saying is, listen, in me you have hope. Following me, you have hope. So I want you to take this little light, no matter how frail your faith or no matter how much it seems to be flickering, like I want you to take this little flame and I want you to look that glacier in the eye and I want you to believe that you can melt that sucker. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Hide it under a bushel. I'm gonna let it shine, 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 shine. Do you see? He wants you to draw near to him. Do that. Don't give up, brother or sister. Draw near to Jesus. He is the great light of the world. We've used this metaphor before, right? It's like when the coals fall away from the fire sometimes and they start to get dark. What do? You take that coal and you put it by the fire and it just starts to get red hot again, doesn't it? Draw near to him. Let him fuel you and illumine you. Worship team, would you come up? Now, at the end here, an important question. How? Whether you are a Christian or not yet a Christian, you should ask, how do I have the light of life so that I don't have to walk in the darkness? How do I get that light of life? And whether you're a follower of Jesus or not, the answer is the same for all of us. Our God is no Santa. His reward does not depend on your being naughty or nice. Are you listening to me? For even if you were nice, it would not be enough. There isn't enough niceness in you to commend yourself to this God. There is none righteous, no, not one. There is nothing in you truly good apart from Christ. You must acknowledge that you are a sinner in desperate need of outside help, of outside light. That's what Isaiah said. On them the light has dawned upon you. The opportunity for the light of Christmas to be yours year round, okay? Never ends, is found only in coming with the empty hands of faith to Christ. This is what John goes on to write about, on from the passage that Todd read for us. To all who believe him and accept the free gift that is Jesus, he will give the right to become the children of God and lights in this world. They are reborn, not with a physical birth from human will or plan or doing, but from God. And the only way to continue to walk in the light is by simply looking upward and continually walking with him. I am the light of the world. And anyone who follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Believe in him now. Declare him to the world. Amen.